I would encourage our friends and colleagues on the West not to just listen to what Mossad claims, right? Of course, Mossad's going to claim that we were behind this and we have this enormous power to do that and this and that. But we should also listen to the actual protests, actual Iranians who have been taking to the street, taking to social media to articulate their demands, demands, which are extremely wide-ranging.
And returning to the start of our conversation around Kashavarzian, it would be a whole lot easier and natural for Iran to evolve in a productive direction if international law, the UN Charter, were the North Star for Western leaders.
Absolutely. And it's really tragic, as you to go back to your opening question, that even members of the United Nations aren't actually defending the UN Charter and not upholding this. So the pressure is on us progressives who should be fighting for the rule of law, for protection of disadvantaged and disenfranchised groups within our society, working class peoples, and so forth, because those are the exact same people in Iran that are making the exact same sorts of demands and are facing the exact same sorts of challenges. And that's the way to build these sorts of bridges, is to not only listen to colleagues inside Iran, but also listen to our colleagues in the US and in Canada that are also making similar sorts of demands for greater justice and accountability, ultimately.
Iran Kashavarzian is Associate Professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at New York University. He's the author of Bazaar and State in Iran, Politics of the Tehran Marketplace, Geographies and Histories of the Iranian Revolution, and Making Space for the Gulf, Histories of Regionalism and the Middle East. We shall link to Iran Kashavarzian's webpage and to his favorite news sources on Iran at greenplanetmonitor.net. We shall also post a video of our complete conversation, which goes on for a while. You are listening to the GPM. I'm David Kattenberg. Boys will be boys. Tech bros certainly will. While Donald Trump and his crusading war minister, Pete Hegseth, vow to rain hellfire down on Iran, Silicon Valley titans pronounce on how they intend to rule the world, backed by AI-based weapons and mass surveillance. One of them does, for sure. Over a mid-April weekend, AI wunderkind Alex Karp, founder of the surveillance giant Palantir, posted a 22-point manifesto all about this. Like all manifestos, Alex Karp's pronouncement bursts with big narrative. The technological republic owes a moral debt to America and the world, and free email won't cover the bill, Karp's manifesto says. Civilizational decadence, vacant and hollow pluralism, and the dysfunctional and regressive belief that all cultures are equal must be squashed, says Karp. Karp's fixes? AI-based military deterrence, obligatory national duty, as if humans have something to offer in his dystopian future, restored religious belief at upper state echelons, and the remilitarization of Germany and Japan. Inevitably, Alex Karp's manifesto has drawn fire among those speaking out. A group of academics at the University of Ottawa, David Murakami Wood, is professor of criminology in U Ottawa's Faculty of Social Sciences and Canada Research Chair in Critical Surveillance and Security Studies. The GPM reached David Murakami Wood in Ottawa.
Let's talk about Palantir's manifesto, 22 ideas summarized on X, largely drawn, I gather, from this book entitled The Technological Republic, which is a scary
exactly.
notion, written by these two guys, Alex Karp and Nicholas Zemyska, which yeah. I've not read. Have you read?
I have the book, and yes, I have been perusing the book. It's, it's one of, I should say, first of all, this is one of a number of different manifestos that have come out of Silicon Valley recently. You know, Mark Andreessen, the venture capitalist who was also associated with Palantir in some ways, wrote his own manifesto online. Balaji, who's the advocate of like free cities and so on, he's also written a kind of manifesto which comes into similar territory. And of course, you know, you can see most of what Elon Musk says as a kind of manifesto in a way. You know, his statements about going to Mars and everything else. They're very fond of these, you know, kind of manifestos. So in some ways, Alex Karp's version of this is just the latest in a long line of these kind of extraordinarily egotistical, very narcissistic in many ways, and of course very white supremacist and European sort of revivalist focused manifestos. They all have those things in common, I think. Basically, they seem to say, you know, look at me. This is how I want the, you know, my achievements and my company represents how the world should be. You know, follow me, follow my ideas. It's a kind of extraordinary form of narcissism, I think.
And they put forward this kind of grand narrative about the way the world and civilization should work, couched in the language of civilizational gravitas.
Exactly. They're very fond of actually the term civilization, you know, rather than humanity or human beings or things like that. They like the term civilization, I think, precisely because it's stripped of, you know, things like the idea of humanity, the idea of humanness or nature or ecology or any of these kind of things. Civilization is somehow separate from those things, and it saves them from having to deal with the difficult questions that come up when you talk about real people or real environments or anything like this. So they're very fond of that. It also allows them to fit into this, as you say, a grand narrative about Europeanness and the idea that somehow Europe was a kind of born to rule the world and this kind of stuff, which is, you know, it's very 19th century in some ways. We're going back to that kind of narrative that was very present in the 19th century that justified gunboat diplomacy and colonialism and many of these kind of things. It's in that sense not new, but it's a digital version. It's supported with AI and computing as its justification.
Now, I'd like to go through these 22 points in the manifesto. We don't have to go through them one after the other. We can summarize them. There are four key ideas. The first is that, according to Palantir and its founder, Alex Karp, there needs to be a fusion of state and technology. Artificial intelligence must be applied to the application of hard power. So it's the end of the atomic age. We need to have AI weapon systems. Thirdly, this idea of hollow pluralism, that not all national cultures are equal. Some are just ineluctably better than others, more advanced. And the fourth one is a little narrower, but kind of scary, this idea that Germany and Japan must be remilitarized, which is a curious one. Let's go through these four sort of subject areas. This idea that state and technology, Silicon Valley, must be fused because they share common interests.
Yeah, I mean, it's so, in some ways, people, I don't think we'd be surprised about this one because, you know, despite the strange idea that, you know, was around for a long time that Silicon Valley was some kind of hippie haven full of, you know, crazy people developing liberating technologies, it's never been that way. I mean, there's a brilliant book by Alex Levine called Surveillance Valley, which talks about, you know, the whole history of Silicon Valley is being infused with the military. I mean, it comes out of the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower talked about. It's a, you know, one of the locations, the prime locations for that. So we have a kind of myth of Silicon Valley that it was somehow once progressive and hippie-like and left because we have that idea about California anyway, which is itself a kind of rather dangerous idea, which has roots in many of the same sorts of intellectual currents that Carp swims in. But so the Silicon Valley has never not been military in that sense. It's very much connected. But the idea that we're now explicitly tying big platform corporations to American imperialist agendas, which is what we're talking about here, when he says the military, he's not meaning every military. He's meaning American military aims and ambitions. Of course, them which connect to America and its allies, whether those are the traditional allies within the Five Eyes network of Canada, USA, you know, UK, New Zealand, and Australia, or the current direction, which seems to be much more towards an axis that involves America, you know, Russia, Israel, and other sorts of, you know, opportunist hangers on. But yeah, this is absolutely an explicit statement of maybe saying the you know, maybe it's saying the quiet part out loud, essentially. This is how it's always been, but we're going to absolutely emphasize this at this point.
And so this idea that governance must be essentially directed by, command and controlled by artificial intelligence systems. And in my in my mind, I have this idea that somewhere down the road in the not too distant future, we will actually be governed by artificial intelligence systems. There will no longer be traditional governing systems and bodies and representative institutions. It'll all be artificial intelligence.
Yeah, that's exactly what he wants. I think, I mean, in a sense, though, but the sense what you've got to understand with that is that I don't think he really envisages these systems as being truly independent. These are, you know, funnily enough, Palantir is an AI company. He's not envisaging any AI, you know, systems ruling this. He's been envisaging the systems that him and people like him design, and those kind of systems, which are essentially, whether he's really believes this or not, you know, are seen as in this manifesto somehow under his control or under the control of these kinds of CEOs and platform corporations. So yes, it's AI in that sense, but I really think that what we talk about when we talk about AI needs to be really interrogated. The idea that somehow we're talking about independent technologies that will have minds of their own is a fiction. We're talking about directed, controlled capitalist technologies by, you know, which are owned and run, trained, organized, you know, by capitalist corporations and their CEOs. And this is exactly what Palantir represents. So, you know, it's one thing to have the sort of AI doom scenario where computers take over and rule us all. I don't think that's what he's really proposing. He's, again, this is a manifesto, like most of these manifestos, in his own image, right? It's reflecting his interests, his corporation's power, and its sources of income, and applying that to politics. He's not the first person. I mean, I wrote an article a few years ago about Zuckerberg's kind of message to his global community, which was in 2016 or something. He wrote a similar kind of manifesto. And at that time, that was all, you know, we can do all this stuff that government does better than governments. And this is a very normal attitude amongst Silicon Valley people. They really think that they are cleverer, better, more advanced, in some ways from better genetic stock, and we'll come back to that later. They think they're genetically better than other people, and they're fitter, you know, fitter, more suited to ruling the world. There was a statement by one of the early programmers from Roblox, which is a kid's website. Even people like that, you know, saying things like, and he wrote this on Twitter years ago, you know, Silicon Valley built the world. This is what he says. Why shouldn't we run it?
And of course, the eternal question about technologies is, are they good or bad? And the fundamental question is, well, I suppose they're neutral, but who controls the development of technologies? Who drives their implementation?
Absolutely. What we've seen in the industrial age, you know, again, from the 19th century, sort of late 18th century, 19th century onwards, is a movement towards increasingly centralized and controlled forms of technology. And this is one of the reasons why, for example, you know, the Luddites have become popular again now. You see a lot of books coming out about the Luddites and how we, you know, machine breakers, we should understand them differently. And it's true, right? Because they represented a stage of development where you had people with, you know, basic technologies under their own control, managing their own economic activity. And then you had factory owners coming in and saying, no, we want you all to go into factories, work with our machines where we can monitor you, we can control you, and we will enjoy the fruits of your labor. And that was a protest against that kind of centralization. But ever since then, we've accepted somehow that technologies are the product of big corporations, centrally run states, and so on, and that we've ceded our control over technological development to these people. And this is, you know, these manifestos in some ways are a product of that, you know, kind of process which has gradually taken the idea of technology away from individuals and away from communities. And away from, you know, collective groups of people, and put it in the hands of capitalists. And of course, not just capitalists, but also states at various stages.
So this technological manifesto, Palantir's manifesto, it downplays the idea of, and totally rejects the idea of soft power and the desired idea of states being the most successful competitive if they can develop ways to project their power in soft ways. But here, This technological republic, this manifesto, puts forward the idea that AI should be used to advance the implementation of hard power. Right. The question is not whether AI weapons will be built. It is who will build them and for what purpose. And the atomic age is ending. One age of deterrence, the atomic age is ending, and a new era of deterrence built on AI is set to begin. Scary stuff.
Absolutely. And there's a very interesting development that's, you know, is really made manifest in the Trump era in the USA in particular, where you haven't just got this kind of hubristic, narcissistic kind of like attitude. It's combined with a kind of an attitude to masculinity and an attitude to, you know, traditionally masculine domains, of which war is the most traditionally masculine domain, right? And this manifesto is absolutely stuffed with that kind of like, you know, very hyper macho sort of attitude. You know, soft power is essentially seen as female, as, you know, as kind of weak, and anything that's female and weak and anything that's like in that category is to be, you know, despised, and we don't want to do that anymore. We want, as Pete Hegseth has said, we don't want a Department of Defense, we want a Department of War. We want to, like, you know, we don't want to have laws that restrict what combatants can do. We want to, you know, fight to the ultimate victory and this kind of stuff. It's kind of schoolboy ideas of what being a man constitutes. It's a kind of masculinity. It derives from playground politics in a way that it's a really sort of, and you see this everywhere with the, you know, the online movements, people like, you know, Andrew Tate, you know, telling people they should grow up to be pimps and kind of control women, right through to Trump saying, you know, we don't really respect international law anymore and we're going to use these things. And these manifestos essentially put that kind of combination of, you know, this sort of hubris, this technological centric ideas together with that sort of new masculinity. And as we'll see, probably talk about later, the kind of new forms of nationalism and racism, eugenics and fascism, which we'll come back to in a minute. So this, and masculinity, like this fetishism of masculinity and masculine values, it's always been a part of fascism.
And couched in religious values and terms.
Oh, of course.
Let's get back to the AI weapons in a second. But item 20 here says the pervasive intolerance of religious belief in certain circles must be resisted. The elites, this is interesting, the elites' intolerance of religious belief is perhaps one of the most telling signs that its political and project constitutes a less open intellectual movement than many within it would claim, which is interesting, conflating intellectuality and religious belief and faith. But clearly, Karp and this other guy think that religious belief is absolutely central to the projection of hard power using artificial intelligence. And
that's a very bizarre idea. I mean, it's like, you know, he's not the only one. I mean, you know, while there is kind of, you know, in many Silicon Valley corporations and amongst many of those CEOs, there's very little kind of that one can say is particularly religious about them. There are some of them that are manifesting, you know, both new forms of religious belief. And I think Elon Musk is one of those. He has a very sort of future oriented, technological focused sort of religious idea. You know, the idea that we have, our future is in the stars and we're going to be disembodied consciousnesses drifting in space and that kind of stuff. That's not science. It's not rationality. It's religion. But it's accepted as something reasonable because he's the richest man in the world. Karp, on the other hand, you know, along with his co-founder of Palantir, who's not involved in this manifesto, but, you know, certainly is involved in the same sorts of intellectual areas, Peter Thiel, are both very, very religious in their orientation. I mean, Peter Thiel has some weird version of medieval Christianity. I mean, he's got the sort of hellfire and antichrist sort of ideas of Christianity. He's literally given lectures recently on the antichrist and the emergence of the antichrist. The funny thing is with that, of course, is that the antichrist for him seems to be everything except himself and AI and those kind of things, which in many ways would be much better candidates for these things. He's even, for example, characterized Greta Thunberg as one of the legions of the Antichrist, you know, and it's very strange. But Karp's version has come slowly. I mean, when he first met Peter Thiel and they founded Palantir, Thiel described Karp as a socialist. You know, he said he was actually was much more interested in social ideas at that point. His PhD thesis was a work of classical sociology. You know, he studied Talcott Parsons and functionalism and this kind of thing. Very old-fashioned, but was a work of sociology. He's really moved, I think, partly because of the way that, you know, conversations have gone with, I expect, his peers like Thiel, towards a more religious outlook. And this, of course, coincided with this massive resurgence of a very particular kind of white supremacist European focused Christianity in the USA that, you know, was one of the main swells of support behind the election of Trump. And you know, this has now become something that's spread across domains into Silicon Valley. And you've got this, therefore, this kind of really strange fusion of a religion that fundamentally has, you know, Christianity has nothing to say about technology per se, right? Nothing. You know, Jesus doesn't say anything about technology, really. You know, you could interpret some things that he says in that way, but there's no sort of underlying technological attitude within Christianity. And yet this has now been kind of fused and adopted so that somehow we're being told that Christianity mandates centralized technology, that Christianity mandates AI. I mean, as the Pope has been arguing with J.D. Vance and others recently, it's quite clear that this is not a mainstream or traditional Christian attitude in the way that they try to claim at all. In fact, you know, the Pope, as a obviously a representative of one Christian faction of the Catholic Church, has made it quite clear that, you know, there are other duties incumbent on human beings that mean controlling, responsibly using these kinds of systems, not, you know, using them for warfare and weapons and things. He's been very clear about this. And of course, has been dismissed by people like Trump and Carp and others as a kind of woke socialist. It's funny how, you know, that, you know, the very things that Carp used to be, at least according to Peter Thiel, are now the kind of, you know, the things that he's rejecting and arguing are terrible qualities, which we should be rejecting from society in favor of a very particular kind of religious belief. And I don't think it's religion per se, because, you know, who are we going to be targeting all these weapon systems at? Who are the USA and Israel attacking? Well, one of the main things, of course, is the, you know, is Islam. You know, it's not every religion that they're in favor of integrating into this thing. And that's another thing we need to be careful of. Just as it's not AI per se they're talking about, it's their AI. It's not every religion they're talking about, it's their religion. It's their kind of casting of religion they're talking about, their particular kind of weird white supremacist militant Christianity that, you know, that they're trying to associate with their products and their, you know, their profits.
Palantir's manifesto talks about hollow pluralism. It says some cultures have produced vital advances, others remain dysfunctional and regressive. All cultures are now equal, which is not a good thing, according to Palantir, I guess. Criticism and value judgments are forbidden. And then it says, we must resist the shallow temptation of a vacant and hollow pluralism. We in America and more broadly the West have for the past half century resisted defining national cultures in the name of inclusivity, but inclusion at the what? And I've written down here versus diversity, equity, and inclusiveness and affirmative action. So talk about this.
Yeah.
This idea of hollow pluralism that Palantir's manifesto is saying, you know, pluralism, what pluralism?
Well, let's put it out in very simple terms at the beginning. He's a white supremacist. He's a fascist, right? This is classic, you know, kind of hierarchy of nations, hierarchy of races kind of language. We've seen it since the 19th century in the era of scientific racism, you know, trying to kind of rank individual people but and races and nations based on these kind of ideas of, you know, civilizational advancement or so on. I mean, these are so kind of embedded within kind of European attitudes that sometimes we don't even see it anymore. You know, it's, you know, for example, when Britain was colonizing Africa, there were areas of what's now Zimbabwe where the British actually deliberately eliminated evidence of cities that had existed there before. They actually destroyed archaeological sites so that it could not be argued that those people in those areas had, you know, kind of urban civilizations in previous generations. And they actually tried to eliminate that to fit their theory of the hierarchy of nations. You know, we see all over the world massively different pathways of development, all kinds of things that have happened historically over thousands and thousands of years. The idea that somehow, you know, one particular set of nations or people or civilizations is somehow more, is better, has produced more, is superior to another, is just a product of like either sort of wish fulfillment based on this kind of ideas of white supremacy, or simply a product of looking from here now and not understanding that if you look from somewhere else or some other place, things look very different. And so, yeah, this is, again, it's a narcissistic urge, but that's also part of fascism in itself. It's an urge to basically say that, you know, we are the pinnacle of civilization. We are the best. Other people don't count as much. We shouldn't pretend this anymore. And therefore, you know, we should regard our development and our nation as superior. It's classic fascism. And in this case, very much linked to a particular kind of Eurocentric idea of white supremacy. It's very interesting in the case of Karp, right? Because his background is actually very mixed. And it's interesting that he's adopted this kind of civilizational superiority and fascist sort of ideology, because, you know, he's a mixture of all kinds of things. His mother was Jewish, one of his parents was Jewish, as far as I understand it. I'm not sure which one. His other parent was partly African-American, i.e., you know, partly African descended. And he also has German ancestry, which mix, I'm not quite sure. So he's in himself, you know, a very interesting person to be making these kind of claims that are at the very least white supremacist adjacent, if not actually overtly white supremacist, because in many people's castings, especially many contemporary American fascists and the kind of people who are in government now in the USA, he doesn't really qualify as one of us. You know, he's actually, you always get people like this who are kind of, you know, who kind of try to hitch themselves onto this sort of fascism's coattails. And Karp is very much seems to be one of those kinds of people. It's a very interesting phenomenon. I really don't know personally what's going on inside his head, what kind of emotional and psychological things have made him develop in this way that he's become so unaware of his own kind of, you know, his own position and his own origins, that, or kind of so much suppressing them, that he's actually produced a manifesto which is like a kind of a fight by one part of himself against another.
David Murakami Wood is professor of criminology in the University of Ottawa's Faculty of Social Sciences and Canada Research Chair in Critical Surveillance and Security Studies. His research focuses on emerging AI-based smart cities, private surveillance companies, AI regulation, and the relationship between surveillance and the climate crisis. Now, we spoke at length. Watch our complete conversation and link to Palantir's dystopian manifesto at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a joint production of Earth Chronicle Productions and 93.3 CFMU-FM, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Thanks to our news editor, Kylie Wong. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Blueberry, and on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
On CJSF 90.1 FM.
Do you like music, or do you like technology, or do you like talking to people? CJSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CJSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show, and tons more. To find out more information, visit cjsf.ca.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
You are now listening to Home of Burnaby Rock on CJSF 90.1 FM.